There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. On the show this week, who'd work in TV? With reports of lowering safety standards and financial hardships on the rise, I speak to Marcus Ryder about a new Christmas appeal. Also on the programme, Top Gear is being wrested by the BBC, but for how long? All that, plus we follow the latest twists and turns on the Telegraph sale, TikTok pranks that went too far, and in the media quiz, we guess the biggest winners of the week. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, Sam Altman was reinstated as OpenAI CEO this Wednesday, just 5 days after being sacked for not being candid in his communications with the board. Altman's rehiring makes him the company's fourth CEO in just 5 days. ITV hosts their annual upfronts this week, the ITV Palooza, in front of a rowdy audience, and lots of quips about Nigel Farage. ITV also revealed it would show Extraordinary, a Disney TV show, on their platforms in 2024. And the TV presenter and actress Annabelle Giles passed away on Monday after a month-long battle with a brain tumour. Giles had a varied and successful career, appearing on panel shows like Have I Got News For You and Radio 4's Just A Minute. Those paying tribute included Sue Perkins, Krishnan Guru Murphy and Sarah Green. Now joining me at the London Podcast Studios, we welcome back the media writer and journalist Scott Bryan.
Hi, you guys.
I'm very good, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, good. It's a busy time of year, isn't it?
It is quite busy as we get towards Christmas. Also, I've noticed that you've been busy on the old Guardian live blog.
Yes, I've been doing a bake-off live blog following each week within the tent, having a big old moan about how things aren't as good as they used to be. You know, just in general
tell me
sense.
Tell me how it works. Do you do it from home?
I do it from home.
How early do you log on?
I log on half an hour before. There's a lovely community of people who follow it every single week, and then people who try to bake along with all of the different technicals who share me their updates with how they've been getting on. And it's lovely to, I think, have a place that's all about Bake Off in one place rather than when you're on Twitter or X or whatever the hell it is now and you're scrolling on and it's just despair with other stories in the horrible yes. sad world that we're living in at the moment. So but I mean, I think it's really in terms of where we are with this series, we're heading towards the final.
Good series, bad series?
An okay series.
Better than last year?
Yes, anything was better than last year. I think they've gone back to basics in terms of the recipes. They've listened to the audience about all of the complaints they were having. I think Alison Hammond is an absolute delight in the show and has such a great presence. I think the issue was with about midway through, they just decided to do a really hard technical just to kind of find flaws with people, and it just kind of felt like they were going back to old tricks again.
Also joining me from the Press Gazette, it's Charlotte Tobit. Hello.
Hello, Matt.
Have you been watching Bake Off too?
Yes, and that technical drove me mad.
So explain which one it was, people at home.
Do you remember what bake it actually was?
They had to... I mean, it felt like they were baking something that Prulifa thought up in a dream.
Was this the sponge pudding?
The sponge pudding, yes. And you were supposed to steam it, weren't you, for...
45 minutes.
It feels like you know more about this. Yeah, it feels like you know more than I do.
Is it the one where... Basically, the real issue is just the amount of time they give them. And if they're all bad, but they're all just underbaked, then clearly it's just a problem with the actual task,
Yes, exactly. Sorry, that was just me agreeing.
Can I say that I did... bake a technical bake from this year's Bake Off?
Which one?
I baked the lemon and thyme bundt cake.
How did it go?
I'm going to show you a picture and we'll put it on the YouTube feed.
Oh, that looks lovely.
That's really good. A little bit crispy around the side.
A little bit overdone.
Otherwise, presentation good.
I really can't comment when it comes to other people's bakes. Have you seen my baking? I mean, I'm just going to be politically neutral.
Is it still on the BuzzFeed archives?
Yeah, very much so.
If you fancy having a look at it, go and explore. Okay, first story. Want to talk about a stream of stories actually this week about working conditions in the film and TV industry, but it could have implications for every sector because of the ad downturn. First up, a survey by Bechtu and the Mark Milson Foundation into these safety concerns. Scott, what did they reveal?
So they revealed that there is a lot of concern within the industry in regards to the health and safety on productions. They had a survey. And almost three quarters of the 700 or so people responded said that, quote, their safety or that of a colleague has been compromised at work. And of course, this comes from Bechtu that represent workers, also Mark Milson Foundation, that was set up after the death of a British camera operator, Mark Milson, who was killed in 2017, was filming for a car stunt for Black Earth Rising. I mean, I think it feeds into the general kind of situation that many freelancers are finding themselves at the moment, in which they might not feel that they can speak up where they are working just because of the stress that is existing within the industry right now. I mean, you wouldn't want to complain, I feel, about your working practices, because I think there might be a mentality of you should be thankful to be working here, particularly at the moment where opportunities are harder to come by. And I think there is a general sense within the industry of people feeling that they cannot speak up because either they're, in the whole range of issues, not just in regards to this one, because they feel that being a freelance economy, they will somehow not be able to get the work for next job down the line. I mean, that's a very understandable reason why people might not want to speak out. I think such surveys such as these, I think, highlight the concerns that are happening within the industry. And I think highlighting the necessity of there being more stringent rules, because the consequences, particularly when it involves safety on productions, could be, you know, really rather catastrophic.
I mean, Charlotte, there's also sort of obviously a long history of long working hours, aren't there, in the media? But it sort of felt that in that case, sort of progress had been made, maybe sort of working from home. Do you think we're sort of taking a bit of a step back, or is it just really talking about what's always happened?
Probably has always happened, yeah. But it, like in many areas of society, we're in trying to improve things. Like the past 10 years, a lot of things have been unacceptable that previously were just the norm. You know, work is a big part of that. And yeah, more recently working at home. I wonder if it's good that this has come up because, yeah, with lots of the talk about working at home and offices, I think people like crews out in the field and things could maybe get forgotten about. You know, people love a narrative about, you know, office and commuting and home desks and, you know, but this is something quite different, but it's still very, very serious. So the fact that they're making sure that this isn't forgotten, and, you know, 6 years after a death is not, you know, it's still progress can be made, and we make sure that it happens. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next, how seriously they take it.
Well, sort of connected. I mean, we heard this week that the BBC is going to be resting Top Gear in the aftermath of an accident that almost killed presenter Freddie Flintoff. I mean, it's sort of connected, isn't it? I mean, obviously there's some implications for the brand, but it does play to that study.
Yeah, I mean, I think to many people who have been following this story, this official cancellation, or not really a cancellation, suspension, is not really a surprise. I mean, the crew, as I know, has not been in place for a long time now. Many of the people who were attached to this program are now working elsewhere. And of course, safety, in particularly in regards to Freddie Flintoff's injuries and recovery, is the absolute priority. And I think it would have been wrong for the BBC to have just continued making Top Gear as things currently stand. I think what was really interesting to me was comments by James May on the Today programme, or the Today podcast, yesterday, as in Wednesday, where we talked about actually maybe the whole of Top Gear and motoring shows need a rethink, which I felt was really rather interesting when it came from somebody who, of course, was so closely tied to it.
Well, I heard that interview too, and he sort of said, even our show, meaning the great
Grand Tour,
he said it's basically a travel show.
Yeah, I mean, and it has been for some time.
Yeah, sort of car-themed.
Because they went all out for very expensive episodes whilst being incredibly cryptic about how many people were watching. And then, of course, it became much fewer episodes. And now it's like once in a while, whilst, of course, the onus has now moved towards Clarkson's Farm and James May has now got his very BBC Two-style programmes on that platform, essentially going to Japan or doing whatever he likes. And he's a great broadcaster at that. I think, obviously, a lot of Top Gear, even though with the show in more modern years, has tried to, I think, reflect a lot more our sort of modern cultural inclusivity. Mm. I think it's still, just by default, I think pulls itself back to this kind of naughty, laddie thing that doesn't really, I think, exist that much anymore. So I feel that it will take a creative in 5 years, let's say, to come back to it and say, oh, hang on, how can we spin it in this way without feeling like it's treading on the coattails of what made that show so successful in the first place.
I mean, Charlotte, it's difficult for BBC Studios. I mean, this is sort of a core programme for them, and there's versions and there's the website and there's magazines. It doesn't help the big BBC Studios global expansion, does it?
There are probably other things they can do with the brand that they can evolve it. I mean, like, to your previous point about have things always been like this or how's it changed? You know, Richard Hammond has some really serious crushes on Top Gear. Mm. But now we're at a stage where something like that happens and things are over, whereas before it was kind of like, oh, that was bad. Okay, like after a kind of sufficient pause, we'll move on. Mm. But it just feels like things like that are taken so much more seriously now. And so perhaps there's a space for a kind of a more modern Top Gear, like Scott was saying, you know, it's time to change the brand a bit. It's kind of maybe a bit stagnant, but there is some brand recognition there, but that doesn't mean it always has to be the same thing.
I mean, this is a week when BBC are relaunching Doctor Who, its 60th birthday. I mean, that's had some hiatuses over its time as well. They are past masters at recreating something.
They certainly are. I think with the right creative people involved, it can certainly bring new life into the franchise. I think the pressure on the BBC to create globally successful brands is more than ever now. I think before it was like the icing on the cake. Wouldn't it be great to have a show in 150 countries or so? Now it's a bit of a necessity just to plug the £300 or so million worth of programming cuts that they've had to do because of a license fee squeeze. And I think, you know, it's very much a priority now of the BBC to think about how they can extend the show in any way they can. I think it's a primary reason why Doctor Who joined up with Disney Plus, because its distribution is far wider. They could probably have involvement as a co-pro in terms of funding into it too, although we don't really know that much about budgets.
So this is the BBC. You can obviously watch Doctor Who on terrestrial channels and on iPlayer, but outside of the UK, it's going to be on Disney Plus globally, and they've stumped up some cash.
Exclusively, yes.
Yes, they've stumped up potentially, we'd imagine, quite a lot of cash.
Yes.
Which is probably going into the budget.
But also for the BBC's benefit, it's visibility, I think, more than ever. Because, of course, they've got BBC channels in every single country and market practically. I was on holiday last year and I was, I think, in a very nice sunny climb in South America. I turned on the TV and it was Rick Edwards on a random game show, followed by an episode of Doctors. I was like, who is watching this? Who is watching this? Of course, great show by Rick Edwards, but absolutely random location for it to be on.
Charlotte, I was at the Audio Production Awards this week and I was talking to someone about the BBC and they were saying that someone was talking to them and they were concerned that the BBC basically are a sort of international media organisation, sort of with a contract with the government to make some UK programming. Is that the case? Are they transitioning to their sort of future post-licence fee world where actually being a global brand is more important than chucking out some public service telly shows to the UK?
Well, obviously, I look at it usually through the prism of what they do in the news space. And there's been a lot over the past year, as we've talked about before, about local news and what they're doing. And they cut back on local radio, although not as much as they originally intended. But they are investing in online local news, and that upsets the commercial news providers in the UK. So, I mean, it does feel like whatever they do, whether it's locally or nationally in the UK or internationally, it kind of upsets someone, and they're never going to win with everyone. But they are kind of by their nature, I suppose, trying to do all things to all people. And as we already said, they are having to plug a gap by doing more internationally. So you certainly understand why they need to do that, because there are the commercial opportunities there.
I mean, Scott, you've been talking to some of the Doctor Who lot over the past few weeks.
Yes.
Are they making a UK show, or are they making a thing for the whole world?
Oh, I think it's very much a UK show. Mm. I mean, I think it continues on the heritage and success that Doctor Who has had since 2005. I don't think that's any different. And I think that Russell T. Davies has always had a very smart take on the show, which is still have stuff for the fans, but actually make it a show that is attracting a large audience of people every single week. Not leaning into the fandom too much, giving them enough to be satisfied, but they're always going to watch without fail anyway. I think, sort of following on from the previous point, I think it all comes down to about where the BBC is heading next. It's really going to be down to its licence fee renegotiation, because the BBC is still making very much the plan to be a universal service. But if the government has its way, you know, it wants to make it into a subscription service or into a tiered service, the moment that happens, the BBC as we know it is over. The moment, you know, that is it as a universal broadcaster.
But if
it is then going to be catering specifically to those people who are applying for subscriptions, that's when it will be thinking about services of who can be paying the most money for it, how can we go and do that, and therefore the BBC is not really serving everybody anymore.
But I think this is a bit about them getting a slight march on that, and if they can turn themselves into a more global business faster,
yeah,
they've got a better chance of coping with whatever they're given later on.
Yeah,
but it's difficult to get there quickly.
I sort of think that they're trying to do both at the same time. Mm. I think they're trying to satisfy audiences who feel that they will not get their shows from another broadcaster. So still trying to do all of the public service broadcasting commitments that they need to. Remember, there are Ofcom guidelines that say you have to have so many hours of religious programmes, so many hours of educational programmes, so many hours of factual programming. Like, the BBC will have to make those regardless. But also at the same time, trying to now, I think, be very competitive in a global market where there's a lot of money being spent, having those big shows that can help bring in cash. And then that can help, I guess, sustain the universality of the BBC as well. So it's trying to do this two things. I think it's also worthwhile sort of recognising the BBC is a hugely highly regarded global brand. I mean, it is known for having a very different approach than CNN and other fantastic broadcasters and broadcasters.
Well, there's particularly a lot of opportunities around that. And Charlotte, but they're doing a lot of news expansion in the US, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, lots of British news brands are actually we're reaching not a limit in the UK, but certainly obviously there is a limit of advertising and revenue and subscriptions, but there's a lot of untapped potential in the US. Obviously, a lot of some of the brands are going for the big advertising market. Some of them are going for subscriptions from people that they feel aren't being catered to yet. And the BBC obviously it has a unique place among those UK people that are going to the US, but that they see an opportunity both in news and entertainment that isn't quite being filled.
Thanks both. Moving back to conditions for the sector, and as part of our ongoing coverage of the commissioning slowdown and how it's affected the freelance market, I spoke to Marcus Ryder, MBE, the CEO of the film and TV charity. He's just announced a Christmas appeal to support crews and their families. I started by asking Marcus about the hardships people have faced this year.
So to put it in context, in April, we give out financial hardship grants. So it's a limit of £750, but on average, we hand out grants of about £550. Mm. And it doesn't sound like a lot of money, But it's the difference between someone being able to pay the rent or not paying the rent. It's the difference between someone being evicted and not being evicted, being able to pay the gas bill or not paying their electricity bill, choosing between food and electricity. And if you then combine that, which we do, with financial advice and debt advice, it's enough to keep the wolves away from the door and then to restructure your finances, restructure your debts, and work out what you're going to do next and keep people in the industry. And so in April, £30,000 went out our door in those hardship grants. By July, because of there was the writer strike, but more the US writer strike, but more because of cost of living crisis, BBC license fee freeze, ITV and Channel 4 advertising is down, so there's commissioning freeze. And so what you started to see, and you don't have to see Bechtu's stats on this, what you started to see, the need was greater, the demand on those hardship funds were greater. So by the time we get to July, 30,000 out the door had jumped to almost double, which was £55,000 a month in July going out the door. Then we had the actors' strike. So in August, that then jumped to £173,000 out of the door.
And that's then, productions being shut down because no actors to be in them, particularly in drama, which obviously we do huge amounts now in the UK or for US.
You shut down one production, that's literally thousands of people out of work. So we thought 173,000 was bad enough. Come September, it was over $250,000 we were handing out in grants. Now, actor strike, thankfully, has come to an end. And we saw almost an immediate drop in demand for in applications, but what we've seen now is a new normal. It hasn't gone back to 30,000, it's back to 80,000, you know. So we're looking at 150% increase, we're looking at 200% increase in what we would normally see this time of the year, especially in the run-up to Christmas. And with the amount of money that we've had to dip into our reserves, we need more money to actually pay to keep that kind of level up, to make sure that we are not turning people away, because we have a new normal now. The new normal is the fact that there's still a commissioning freeze. You know, ITV and Channel 4 are not commissioning the way they used to. The streamers are not are working to tighter financial models than they were previously. I mean, I'm sure you've covered...
The cash spigot has been somewhat closed.
Yeah, I'm sure you've covered this. Well, I'm not sure. You have covered this in previous shows. And so you know the reality that there is... and I think the people that are really taking the brunt of that is the idea that we have a freelance model. And the freelance model puts all the financial risk onto... Or not all of it. I'm sure people from Netflix and Amazon.
But there's a push down, isn't there? There's a push down from the networks and production companies, and then production companies down to freelancers.
Yeah, and we've seen it in terms of where they would have employed somebody if a production lasted, if a non-scripted production lasted, let's say, 3 months. They are bringing people on for as short a period of time as possible, so you will only have that series producer on for a tiny period of time. Mm-hmm. They will make sure that that director can come on for a shorter period of time, and then the minute they can kick the director off, they're kicked off, and so that there are longer periods of time between work. And then if all of a sudden something isn't commissioned, or something is, the commissioning is paused, you know, the real fear that I have, and the reason why I'm so would appeal for people to give to the charity, is because we're seeing people leave the industry. We're seeing...
it's potentially a massive issue, isn't it? So it's all well and good to say, oh, there's a shutdown, but it'll come back, or the strikes are over, or, you know, the commissioning will restart, but there won't necessarily be people to do the work anymore.
That is the massive problem. And it's not... And it's no longer a hypothetical threat or fear. It's real. You know, it's... People are leaving the industry, where anecdotally we are getting more and more people saying they just can't make it work anymore.
What do freelancers say about how it's affecting them?
So we do a survey every 2 years of the entire industry, and called the Looking Glass Survey. And that's another reason to contribute. Please contribute to the...
We have to measure, don't you? You have to...
Because we have to... You can't solve what you don't measure. Mm. What gets measured gets done. Mm. If you look at that survey, in the year preceding that survey, 29% of people, of respondents to that survey, working in film and television and cinema, had suicidal ideation. 29%. That's a third.
Why is it so high?
Because things are so hard, okay. is the reality.
Yep.
You know, not knowing when your next job is coming. So some of the drivers that we've identified is bullying.
Mm.
So bullying is rife in our industry. It's an issue which people have acknowledged now. And so we do a bullying service to actually try and address that. And there's other, and broadcasters and large indies also acknowledge that it has been a problem. And so it is being addressed. But it's not solved.
And often that's levels of pressure, isn't it? So if you're finding it tough already, it's another level that's being pushed on you. And sometimes the pressure you feel pushes someone to bully further.
Exactly. And again, all these things are interconnected. And if you have smaller budgets and you have quicker turnarounds and what have you, so all these things are interconnected. Loneliness is also a massive driver. In cause for mental ill health, and so it's how do we address that? And again, in a freelance setting where you come in for one job and then you don't have that same team around you, or you know, that's also another problem. But there's a number of drivers as to why in our sector mental health is an issue. So, as I said, the stats and the stories that we hear, 29% of people in that year. Had suicidal ideation, 11% committed acts of self-harm. And so, you know, this is just a indication of the fact that we have a mental health crisis. And so we offer free counselling, we offer therapy, we have bullying advice, support as well. But all of this costs money. You know, but if we don't do that, you know, they're obviously just as loving and caring human beings. We want to support these people. But if we love film and television, we want them to stay in the industry. Mm. These are highly skilled people. We are. Oh, it's always dangerous when you pick another profession saying these are not X and like, you know how highly skilled those people are, you know, so, okay, I'm not going
to. But also like back to motivated self-interest, you know, if these people leave the industry, you know, if you're working for a production company, you're going to have to find new people. You're going to have to train them. You're going to have to expend more time and effort and money to do that.
And the reality is that we live in a international market, and a large part of it is, let's be frank about it, it's American productions saying, where can I go? And while the tax relief and the tax breaks are really important in attracting these massive productions, one of the brilliant reasons, one of the fantastic reasons that they come to Britain is not just because of the tax break, let's be honest about it, it's also because we have the infrastructure, we have the skill base. So if you know, had tax breaks in a place which did not have the skills and the human capital that could actually deliver. It won't make any difference. And so if these people leave the industry, you know, the reality is that they will go elsewhere. Mm. Those massive US productions will go elsewhere. And then that will have a multiplier effect. And then you'll see, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people out of work.
That was Marcus Ryder. We'll drop an extended interview with Marcus on the feed for Monday. To donate to the Film and TV Appeal, head to filmtvcharity.org.uk. filmtvcharity.org.uk. There's a link to donate in the show notes as well. And if you've been affected by the issues raised, remember there's always someone to talk to or text, as well as the charity. The Samaritans can be reached on 116 123. And you can check the show notes for details about that outside the UK and Ireland. We'll be back with more media news after this.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, Scott and Charlotte are back. Now, I need to be careful not to say Scott and Charlene are back. That's what I really want to say.
Especially for you.
Neighbours flashback. But no, Scott and Charlotte are back. Time for some more news. The Telegraph auction has been paused. What's been happening? Latest turn of this screw.
Let's just say earlier this week I had to have a proper, oh God, what has happened? What does this mean? So to basically say what the latest is, and it might still have changed actually, but because there was a deadline this afternoon, so by the time this comes out, who knows? Mm. But for now, the Barclay family, who did own the Telegraph before Lloyd seized it because they owed them £1 billion in debt, they've got together with the former CNN president, Jeff Zucker, he's now CEO of an investment group called Redbird IMI, and they are based in Abu Dhabi, and then them together with some Abu Dhabi royalty, I can't remember his name, but he's the owner of Manchester City Football Club as well, they've put a bid together for about $1.2 billion, which would buy back the debt basically, and then
they're sort of saying never mind the sale, how about we just pay back what we owe.
Yeah, so they kind of get first dibs almost if they can repay it, and then what Redbird IMI said is if that happens, then they essentially they would have the option to transfer that into shares, and they would essentially want to do that as soon as possible and get full ownership. And so they put out a statement on Monday.
So that's interesting. So it's not that the Telegraph people want it back themselves.
Well, it is a bit confusing.
Or is it we're going to own it with Redbird?
There is a bit of a question mark over that, I think, because previously it was framed as Barclays very much having it back, but now it seems that it would kind of maybe be Jeff Zucker. So more to follow, I'm sure. Yes.
Is it worth 1.2 billion quid? Because the other bidders maybe not weren't really.
Yeah,
in that
no.
Ballpark.
So they wouldn't have gone that high. No. So it is over. Yeah.
But I suppose guarantees it for that consortium,
which is exactly why they would.
Why Redbird are in?
Go first. Mm. Yeah, exactly. So essentially, now the auction price has been paused while that's kind of looked at, all the due diligence, all the legal stuff, etc. And so basically to stop the other potential bidders from having to bother, while that might be the main thing. So that's like male owner Lord Rothermere, National World owner David Montgomery, GB News investor Sir Paul Marshall. They were kind of the other front runners still. So I'm sure they're still like waiting the wings to see what happens.
What a gang.
So, yeah. But basically what happens next is... the Culture Secretary, Lucy Fraser, has said she's minded to intervene with a public interest intervention notice and has asked Ofcom and the Competition and Markets Authority to look to see if there is anything that she should be intervening over, and if so, they would there would be like a proper investigation, and that's obviously because of the foreign money. So now...
But not... I mean, if you look at a lot of our national newspapers, past and present... the foreign people have owned them, or and still, yeah, the Murdoch Press, it's not, you know, UK, it's a UK-based company, but it's owned by an Australian-American-based firm.
Yeah, and Evening Standard Independent, a major shareholder is Evgeny Lebedev. Yeah, so that's where we're at, basically. They Redbird had a chance to kind of respond, and the deadline was Thursday afternoon, and then Lucy Fraser will...
I mean, Scott, it gives the... I mean, the government love getting involved in media things, mainly because they're all ex-journalists. but
all of them.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
With an approaching election, it sort of gives them the ability to, you know, make people sing their tune a little bit if they're going to decide what happens to deals.
I mean, possibly. I mean, I just find this whole story rather... fascinating, just because of maybe the intentions of who wants to own these titles really for. Because I feel like for Murdoch, the Spectator has been something that I think he just has wanted for ages.
Just likes the product.
I read a really interesting article, I think, with Lord Rothermere. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was the Financial Times.
It was in the Times.
Close. Close enough. Apologies. But that was, I think, interesting because... you know, they want to have it because of the fact that the Telegraph has built a good membership model, has had a metered paywall, and but have an awful lot of people who they can reach on email, and it's something that they are trying to do with their own titles. But of course, if they had them in one big shot, then that would be very beneficial.
Older right-wing pot.
But I guess that would cause questions about... with the competition and market authorities about share, what would happen to the I newspaper, would that get offloaded to somebody else, and so forth. And then of course you look at GB News's owner Paul Marshall, and then you look at how GB News has been formed, and you can see by just the sheer amount of cabinet ministers who are now as main hosts and presenters, that is just purely, I feel, as a political influence tool rather than it is as a business enterprise.
Well, this is a lot of it is influence, isn't it? I mean, this is the Abu Dhabi investment. This isn't because they're necessarily massive fans of the great journalistic work of the team at the Telegraph. It's that they wanted a trophy asset to sit alongside Man City.
Yeah, and it was interesting that the Telegraph themselves had a leader column this week saying, we understand that readers might be concerned about this.
Slash the staff.
Yeah, yeah. And we agree that we need like assurances that if this happens, we'll keep editorial independence, etc. And I mean, it's perfectly possible that they'd be completely independent, of course, even, you know, people obviously look at worst case scenario, as you should, but slightly different. But, you know, people talk about like Lord Rothermere, for example, and the male titles. But I spoke to iEditor Ollie Duff quite recently, and he said, you know, no way Lord Rothermere gets involved, like he never ever. So it's right to worry about that, but that won't necessarily happen. But yeah, and you say about the political influence, and yes, it's very strong for that. But also in the US, I think I read somewhere, and again, I can't remember where for this one, but possibly Jeff Zucker would be thinking that the Telegraph, because a few of them are thinking it could expand into the US. They think there's kind of a centre-right pool of people in the US that the Telegraph could suit. And obviously there's an election coming up there also. Yep.
That's if there are any centre-right Americans left in the market to target. Also in newspapers, The Guardian have announced their own cookie-free ad product. We've touched on this a little bit over the past few weeks. This is the Google... also the internet, Google rules are changing about cookies and accessing other people's cookies, third-party cookies. We talked about the Mail Online's own solution last week. Charlotte, what are the Guardian offering?
So it's called Guardian Light, as in a light bulb.
Okay.
And it's basically they're trying to make sure that they can give personalised advertising to the people that just click reject all, which
right, yes.
Was also in the news this week, because it's, reject all should always be a one-click option, and often it's not, and I think they're going to crack down on that. But so this will become even more important, because probably when people realise how they can reject, they will.
I talked to my mum, we were talking about cookie banners. She's not like super techno literate.
Yeah.
And I said, we can just press reject all. And she went, can I press that?
Yeah.
Which I thought was actually quite a good statement, because you sometimes think, well, if I say no, I'll be redirected always to the Yahoo homepage. I don't know why that's always the case. It seems to be that's the rejection option.
Or at least like there's something major on the webpage you won't be able to see or use, and you'll be missing out some major bit of the experience. But that shouldn't usually be the case, occasionally. But yeah, basically they've just got this new kind of privacy aware thing. They say they're the first news publisher in the UK to have it. So basically you'll get like what they say is a contextually relevant ad, for example, for a food brand on a recipes page, but it hasn't used any personal data. So that's the kind of thing that advertisers want, rather than if you can't use any no personalization at the moment, then you'll just get random
insurance
stuff
ad and, or whatever.
Yeah.
Scott, I mean, sort of having a food ad next to a food section, it just seems, are we back to like 1985 of just like if you've got a food supplement, you'd be not surprised to find a MaggiMix advert in it.
Yeah, I mean, I also think just from a consumer perspective, they're just so annoyed of the whole bloody system in the first place. Like just the fact that on every single website you will ever go on forever, you will have a box that comes up that says allow or reject. It's like, just give me the bloody news. This is all that I'm here to see. This is the reason why I'm on there. And it does feel that like all of the rules that have been put in place have made it more frustrating for the consumer than perhaps the advert selection that's there to help them guide them products. I'm not of that world per se. I can only sort of speak as somebody who goes on the internet a lot, but it's something that I think needs to just be a lot more smoother for people. And
I think there's also a question that sometimes the sort of more non-personalized ads seem less intrusive for customers and visitors, and you're like, oh, I'm more likely to look at the ads. I'm sort of scared at being followed, that sofa is following me around the internet.
You know what the creepiest one of all? The adverts that say your name. So it's happened a few times on Channel 4 or All 4 or 4OD or whatever, where it just goes, Scott, there's this new car open. The other day I was on there and it gave a advert for, I think, one of the main electronics chains. And then it then said, oh, by the way, your nearest shop is in Bethnal Green. And then it showed on the map during the adverts. And I was like, no, get out. Just get
too
out.
Much.
No, this is too much. I can understand some whiz has gone, oh, AI and technology. And we can just say where they live and just give them their postcode and say whether they're at home alone just to sell them a product. Don't do that. Don't do that.
Well, staying on the sort of internet frenzy, granddad, I'm just seeing.
It's been a long week.
It just didn't, what you think about this. So are you aware of Mizzy, the self-styled TikTok prankster, has been jailed for 18 weeks by a judge who also said his TikTok videos were not funny. And this is a guy, basically, he's sort of doing stunts that are just really aggressive, aren't they? It's not even sort of funny. It's like rushing into people's houses and scaring them.
Yeah, like goes beyond that. Like a thing that's bad enough is like a lot of people on the internet posting videos of people in the street without their permission, whether they're just going about their day or whether you interact with them as well. And he kind of took that even further. That judge quote was so funny. I think the headline slightly takes it out of context. But really he said like it was more of an admonishment rather than a judgment on his sense of humour, I think. But yeah, I think it's good that because he literally, after he was last in court, he like went on TV, I think was
News
like,
Night.
Yeah, and was like, the law is stupid and I'm just going to do it again. Yeah. So you do need to make an example sometimes.
Also, I sort of, when I sort of saw it all kick up originally, I think it went to Piers Morgan too, didn't he?
Yeah.
That it's all about basically likes. It's the extreme version of wanting internet attention.
Yeah.
And going for, and as a young, as a very young person who hasn't maybe considered much more about his life, just thinks, hey, this gets more interaction, more likes, more likes, more likes. I will do more and more extreme things.
Well, the way that I sort of see it, though, is that journalists have a responsibility about how much they cover these stories. Because I think in this case, you know, once you have somebody who is essentially a public troll, then given media attention for how much they are going to be, that they are a troll, it gives them a national platform to, I guess, give them what they want. Mm. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying avoid it. I think you can sometimes question it and make it accountable, and journalism should not be therefore skipping stories. But I think there has to be a sensitivity around it, and have people questioning the purpose of having and interviewing these people, as they would do with a whole range of different subjects. And you are right about just likes and attention. I sort of find the TikTok age that we're in on social media very similar to the YouTube sort of explosion that we had about 10 years ago.
The first wave of vloggers,
just a lot of people doing a lot of things for attention,
like Logan Paul at the Suicide Forest, yeah. that kind of vibe.
And also part of the reason that telly put people like Mizzy on is to again get clicks. Like it's the same sort of thing. They want people to click on the YouTube versions of that, or to attract attention back to that.
I
mean,
I wouldn't say it's just for, you know, view sake in itself.
I bet in that editorial meeting there was probably a like, oh, this will go viral, won't it, when we have him?
Possibly. I mean, it's hard to know exactly what the conversations are within those newsrooms. I think that there are multiple factors in play at the same time, and of course it depends on the outlet and the reason whether they would want that person to be on or not. But I think there is a question about how much do you fuel the flames, essentially.
Speaking about people and newsrooms asking questions, I did enjoy who someone was after and instead got through to you this week, Scott.
What was that?
Someone wanted you to talk about I'm a Celebrity.
Oh, yeah. I was contacted by a news broadcaster this week, and I think what happened was they meant me to go on to talk about I'm a Celebrity, but instead they had sent the email that they were meaning to send Christine Hamilton's agent. So it's like, can we have Christine Hamilton on? Just straight to my email. A car can pick her up and do her makeup. Let me know. It'd be great to have her on the programme. So I then responded, unfortunately, I'm in Salford. I can't help with this item. And then I responded a minute later, and I'm not Christine Hamilton.
Any reply?
Yeah, they said, whoops, sorry.
Lovely. Well, speaking of winning, and I see that that's winning this week, there's just enough time for the media quiz, which this week's entitled, And the Winner Is. There have been a few winners this week as various media awards dues have taken place. I'm going to give you the category.
Yeah.
You tell me the winner.
Woo.
It's best of three. Buzz in with your names if you know the answer. So Charlotte, you will say
Charlotte.
And Scott, you will say
Christine Hamilton.
Let's play. And the winner is... Right, question number one. Best comedy.
Christine Hamilton. Derry Girls.
Yes, correct.
I mean, what
else? Which
award
ceremony?
International Emmys. Of Lisa McGee's, like... She's won so many awards now. Once I saw her at the RTS Awards, where I think she won two, and she had literal difficulty trying to stuff her awards into her bag and get the zip up. And I would say to her at the time, that is being successful when you're having problems like this.
And Derry Girls actually shared the award with someone. An extra bonus point if you know who they shared it with.
Sorry, Lisa.
An Indian Netflix comedy special. Moving on, question number two. So this is the category, Audio Network or Publisher of the Year?
Charlotte. Resonance FM.
Correct. Resonance FM. They won at the Audio Production Awards, which took place on Wednesday. Scott, Resonance is a community arts radio station in London.
Yeah.
Sort of quite surprising that they managed to beat the big boys and girls.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that's great, isn't it? Because sometimes I think that smaller networks think on their feet, have to have creative ideas. I've always been a firm believer sometimes that it always comes down to creativity. Money, of course, is great.
Helps.
But an idea is greater than money.
I remember when Resonance first started, I think it's just celebrated 25 years, and they had a show where a mother pushed around a pram around like a local garden, a local park, and she had a microphone inside the pram, and so you sort of picked up this soundscape and like snatched bits of conversation as you went around the park, which I thought was quite lovely.
That's lovely.
Right, point each. Well done. So it's all on this. Question number three. Slightly different. Who won a 10-year contract this week?
Oh! Kristen Hamilton. Yes. I always get their names mixed up. Jackie O and...
Kyle
and Jackie O. Yes, of course. The next word I was going to say.
Who are Kyle and Jackie O, if people aren't aware of their work?
They are very well-known Australian radio presenters. They've been on that station for years. I remember that they have been embroiled in quite a few controversies, some serious, some not so serious. I listened to their announcement to say that they're going to be staying on. And, of course, the immediate shudder where they swore within 10 seconds because, of course, you're not used to having... Like, I was listening
on
to...
On Breakfast Radio as well.
On Breakfast Radio because I was listening to Nick Grimshaw's and... Annie Max, great new podcast. And of course, they swear on that too because it's a podcast. Mm. And that still kind of unnerves me. I'm not against swearing. So I'm not used to hearing very established radio broadcasters swearing randomly between them because, of course, that's on sounds. But they do it all the time on Jackie O. It's interesting, isn't it, that it's a 10-year commitment?
Yeah, so this is a 10-year deal worth around 200 million Australian dollars.
Gosh.
So long amount of time, big money. So the reason they have sprung for this much cash, this is ARN in Australia, is the show is hugely successful, very profitable for ARN. They're also going to start simulcasting it into another capital city, so it's going to go into another place, and so it'll make, they believe, some more money from that location. And they reckon it'll cost them, like, new money, about $3 or $4 million a year over that contract. Like, the advertising that will flow from this deal will make it work for them.
But it is also just a little bit kind of unnerving to have a commitment about the future of media when it's all shifting, particularly when it comes to audio shifting in a big way. I mean, of course, they can launch more audio products, have more available on demand. But for you to just go, yeah, we're going to sign up with this talent for 10 years and in 10 years time, it's still going to be great, is a very big move.
It is. I did sort of think, like, is there some talent? And we sort of obviously touched on Clarkson already on today's show that has a good chance actually of remaining. And in a world where everything gets split a million ways, taking some big bets to secure them, even for the beginning of that contract, might work out. Charlotte, I also think often about columnists. Like, columnists often for newspapers get kind of big money, and you think, really, is this sort of person worth it to those outlets? But they love them.
It's true. I mean, you see, even like today is the day after Budget Day, and some of the newspaper front pages, I think the Telegraph, I'm thinking in particular, at the top, they've got all the columnists. Yeah, like, these are the people that are talking about the budget, and that's what the readers want. But I think of Boris Johnson at the Daily Mail, massive. Daily Mail front page often has half the front page is often trailing a column. I don't know if there's any evidence. I'd love to see evidence of, like, linking the columnists and other big names to the money. But
I think often there's that audience connection on anything, TV, radio, internet, TikTok, or newspapers, where it's familiarity. You sort of know what to expect. You like the content, and it sort of keeps you coming back, doesn't it? Whereas more esoteric things like the news or music maybe has less of that pull for these big brands.
Well, it's like that's kind of why podcasts have done well, isn't it? People like the personalities on there, so it's kind of the same thing, just transplanted to a different medium.
It is, and thank you, the media podcast listener, for sticking with the great talent that you've got here. Scott?
What does Christine win?
Well, obviously she gets a car and makeup wherever she wants. And
she also gets my emails.
She also gets a 10-year, $20 contract.
Wow.
For the media podcast. Well done to her. And thank you both. Where can people keep up with what you're writing, Charlotte?
Pressgazette.co.uk.
Excellent. And Scott?
At ScottyGB everywhere on social media, pretty much.
Lovely. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it from us today at the London Podcast Studios. It's where all the cool kids are. And remember, you can get 25% off your first booking when you use the code MEDIAPOD at thelondonpodcaststudios.com. That's thelondonpodcaststudios.com. Use the code MEDIAPOD for 25% off. And if you're new to the show, remember to hit follow on your podcast app of choice to get us in your ears all year round. My name is Matt Deegan. The producer was Matt Hill, with support from Maya Cedar Lund. It was a Rethink Audio production. production, and I'll see you next week.